Our reading this evening is from John chapter 12, and you'll find it on page 1084, where we're beginning at verse 27. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. The crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. Others said, an angel has spoken to him. Jesus answered, this voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So the crowd answered him, we have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? So Jesus said to them, the light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtakes you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Do keep that open, page 1084 if you've lost it. And if you're new, you'll find these white sheets hopefully will be a help to you. There's pens coming round if that's also a help in staying on topic. I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine a while back, and we got on to talking about Christian things, and I remember distinctly him saying to me, look, Andrew, if there is a creator God who is trying to communicate with humankind, would he really do it through one Jewish peasant in one place at one time? I mean, for the God of the whole universe, isn't that all a little bit parochial, a little bit small and pathetic? I don't know if you've thought about that question or if it's a question for you. Perhaps it resonates with you. Perhaps you think, well, you know, sure, there's some great teachings in the Bible, some miracles and so on. But really, is that the best God can do, that ancient book? And not being present company accepted, but this ragbag group of followers, is that really the best he could do? It all seems so underwhelming. You know, if God's there, why doesn't God just put up a permanent banner in the sky telling humanity what we need to know? And actually, if we're believers, I think often the way we behave shows how much we've bought into that kind of way of thinking. So perhaps one reason we don't talk as much as we might about Jesus is because actually we don't think he'd be that convincing to others. We've bought into it. Perhaps we don't point people to the Bible much or to church because actually they do seem pretty weak. Now, maybe if there was something really impressive, then we would point them to, you know, more impressive events or more impressive people or presentations. It might be a bit different, but the reality is it's all a bit weak. Now, interestingly, this unimpressive nature of Christianity has been a big issue right from the beginning. The elite in Jesus' day struggled to take Jesus seriously at all. He didn't go to the right school or the right college or come from the right place. In fact, back in chapter 1 of John, when Nathanael, one of the disciples, first hears about Jesus, he says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And as you look at Jesus' life, he teaches, he teaches a bit, he travels about with a bunch of nobodies, and then he's gone. And only a handful of people on the whole planet even know or are even aware that he's come. So it all seems ludicrously low-key. But actually, there was something even harder to swallow, which was deeply unimpressive. There's a piece of graffiti that was dug up in Rome, believed to date from the late 200s AD. And I don't know if you've seen this before, but there's a human-like figure with a donkey head on the right. attached to a cross, which I guess represents Jesus. And to the left is a boy called Alexamenos with a hand raised up in prayer. And below are these mocking words, Alexamenos worships his God. And it's probably the sort of thing that goes on in schools. You know, schoolboys scratch on the inside of their desks or on the toilet wall, just some mock, some joke against his friend. But it's interesting, isn't it? What kind of a God would shamefully end his life strung up on a wooden cross? Now, the cross is familiar to us as a symbol, so we miss the shame of it, the shock of it. But still today, Muslims insist that Jesus couldn't have died on the cross. You know, someone else must have taken Jesus' place at the last minute because it would be too shameful for a prophet of God, which is what they believe Jesus is, to die as a common criminal. But what our passage shows us today is that Jesus and God the Father, far from covering up the weakness and the shamefulness of the cross, they actually show that it's not just deliberate, but that it's supremely glorious. So let's look at the verses under our first heading there on the sheets. The supreme display of God's glory is the cross. And we see, first of all, that Jesus is committed to the cross as the supreme display of the Father's glory. So the context, and you'll notice if you were here the last couple of weeks, we're in Jerusalem days before Jesus is arrested and tortured and killed. And actually the prospect of what is about to happen is horrifying to Jesus. So let's pick it up from verse 27. Jesus says, "Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour." So as Jesus considers not simply the physical suffering which approaches, but especially as he considers the cup of God's wrath, which he's going to have to drain, he naturally recoils from it. But you see, the one thing that keeps him pressing on and keeping going is this thing, his concern to glorify his Father. So let's keep going, verse 27. "But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." So Jesus has already declared in John's Gospel, chapter 7, that his great purpose in life is to seek the Father's glory. And here he declares that his imminent death on the cross is not a mistake or a disaster. It's actually the very reason he's come. And that somehow dying on the cross is going to be the supreme display of his Father's glory. And then immediately it's confirmed that not only Jesus, but also, next point, the Father is committed to the cross as the supreme display of his glory. So let's keep going. Verse 28. "Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven. "I have glorified it." I.e. the Father has glorified his name through Jesus' life and his miracles. And then he continues. "And I will glorify it again." I.e. the Father will answer Jesus' prayer and he will glorify his name through Jesus dying on the cross. Now actually, it's pretty unusual for God to speak from heaven. I don't have to tell you that. Probably you've noticed that in your life. And obviously it's unusual today, but it was actually pretty unusual in the life of Jesus. It only happened on two other occasions. Once at Jesus' baptism and then another time at his transfiguration. And so this clearly, him speaking from heaven, is a very significant moment. So what's going on is the Father wants to declare, so that it's beyond any doubt, that what is about to happen is the supreme display of divine glory. Now I think it's helpful for us to step back and to actually consider this whole topic of glory and how it's presented in John's Gospel. Which is arguably the topic which holds the whole of the gospel together. John tells us that Jesus, as God, has always had glory, even before creation. So he says in Jesus prays in chapter 17, "And now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed." So Jesus has always had glory, but with Jesus' birth and then throughout his life on earth, at last, this glory that he has within himself was made visible to human beings. So chapter 1 says this, and the Word, which is Jesus, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. So it's saying there that this outshining of the divine nature, this display of God's godness, this Shekinah glory, as it's called in Hebrew, this glory of God which Moses glimpsed back when in Exodus when he was asked to hide in the cleft of the rock, or the glory of God which was in that bright cloud which led the Israelites across the wilderness, or the glory of God which was seen at the dedication of the temple, this glory has now appeared in the person of Jesus. So Jesus is the ultimate shining forth to show humanity what God is really like. But actually, what we discover in John's Gospel is that it was a strange kind of glory. So this glory was hardly noticeable to most people. So in chapter 1, John the Baptist says that if God hadn't specifically pointed Jesus out to him, John would never have noticed Jesus. Now, if you watch look at old pictures of Jesus, or if you watch modern films of him, you can always pick out in the room which one's Jesus. I mean, even if he doesn't have a glow to him, he's always a bit taller, a bit more impressive. He always looks like a presidential candidate. But John the Baptist says it wasn't like that. You wouldn't have picked him out in a crowd. Now, Jesus' glory was, of course, seen in his miracles. And we see that specifically mentioned in chapter 2 and chapter 11. But Jesus' glory was also seen in his weakness and in his ordinariness and in his suffering. And above all, as we're seeing in this passage, Jesus' glory was seen at the cross. And actually, this is a big part of John's purpose in writing, to show us that the cross, far from disqualifying Jesus, far from invalidating his claim to be the Son of God, actually the cross displays Jesus' glory like nothing else. And that is why in John's Gospel, Jesus refers to his death as his glorification. So look back at the passage, verse 23. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And that's speaking about Jesus' death. Well, look at verse 32. Jesus says, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Now, if that's all we had, that verse, we would assume, wouldn't we, that lifted up there, being exalted, must mean Jesus' resurrection, or him being lifted up to heaven. But keep going, verse 33. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So do you see the point? Jesus being lifted up on a cross. That is his exaltation. Do you see the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, they describe Jesus' suffering as the pathway to future glory. But John wants us to see that the cross is actually the place of glory. The cross is where the glory of God shines out most brightly. We just had Winter Olympics, and I guess we've seen one or two bits of it, probably. The cross is like the Olympic podium, that platform that lifts people up. God is lifting Jesus up on the Olympic podium, on the cross, to show off his majestic godness for the whole world to marvel at. Strangely, the cross is God's banner in the sky, if you like, once and for all. And next, in our passage, Jesus goes on to explain why this is. So I put on the sheets, the supreme display of God's glory is the cross because the cross wins the decisive victory. So first, the world's verdict on Jesus is in fact its own judgment. So let's pick it up from verse 31. Jesus says, now is the judgment of this world. Now that is a profoundly ironic statement. If you think about it, Jesus is about to be tried in court. He's about to be sentenced to death. Both Jewish and Gentile leaders and the people themselves are going to have their verdict against Jesus. Kill him, crucify him. And yet Jesus says that judgment is only really going to be a judgment on themselves. When light comes into the world and people prefer darkness rather than light, they're actually condemning themselves, Jesus says. And next, Jesus shows that Satan's victory is in fact his decisive defeat. So let's keep going. Verse 31. Now, Jesus says, will the ruler of this world, which is Satan, be cast out? There's a George Clooney film which you might have seen called The American. And at the climax of that film, there's an assassin on a rooftop with George Clooney in her sights. And at the very moment when she thinks she's done it, she thinks at last she's got, you know, she's killed Clooney, she's got him licked, her rifle's trained on him, the rifle backfires. So he's got the rifle beforehand and he sabotaged it. And she ends up in that moment, as she pulls the trigger, actually shooting herself. And Jesus is saying here that the moment which looks like Satan's greatest triumph, the murder of the Son of God, that, Jesus says, is going to be the moment of Satan's final undoing. But how does that work? Well, you may know, since our first ancestors believed Satan's lies, and when we first rebelled against our Creator, Satan, since that time, has had an unbeatable weapon against every human being. And that weapon is, he says, Angie Latimer has sinned against the holy, glorious, infinite God, and Angie Latimer deserves hell. And actually, that is a knockdown argument. It is unanswerable. And he's right. And that is an invincible weapon for him. But, do you see, as Jesus takes our condemnation on himself, on the cross, that weapon that Satan has against every human being is ripped from his hand. And he's now got nothing left to say against God's people. And he's cast out of the courtroom. As John himself says in Revelation 12, they have conquered Satan. How? By the blood of the Lamb, by Jesus' death. And thirdly, there on the sheets, Jesus' failure is in fact his supreme triumph. So let's keep going. Verse 32. This is the verse we've already looked at. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So do you see the logic? Once Satan has been defeated, of course, there is now nothing left to stop Jesus irresistibly drawing his sheep to himself. There's a point in Star Wars Episode 4, and I think I might have mentioned it before because I love it. Just before Obi-Wan is killed by his nemesis, Darth Vader, in that film, there's a famous moment where Obi-Wan, famous to me, where he utters the immortal words, "Strike me down, and I will become more powerful than you can possibly imagine." not a glimmer of recognition. No, honestly. and if you know the films, you know that is exactly what happens with Obi-Wan Kenobi. His death actually becomes the greatest triumph there could be for the Force. And Jesus is saying in this verse that paradoxically, the moment that seems like his greatest failure, that moment when he's strung up for all to see as a fraud and a loser, cursed by God, that moment, Jesus says, is going to be the moment of his greatest success. That's going to be the moment when he rescues countless multitudes for eternity. So Jesus is saying that what is about to happen to him later that week is the most monumental event in all of history. At the cross, the world will be exposed in its true colours as God-haters. At the cross, the enemy who has enslaved and tyrannised the human race is at last going to be defeated. And at the cross, the salvation of the world is going to be accomplished. And yet you see, well, I guess in the way I've written those statements, each of these things is just dripping with irony. It's deliberate. God is deliberately revealing himself in an odd and an unexpected way. And that brings us onto our final point on the sheets. So you and I need to recognize true glory, where it can be found. Let's read from verse 34. So the crowd answered Jesus, "We have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" So actually the crowd have got something right. They rightly understand that this lifting up is talking about Jesus' death. And they're saying, look, how can you be the Messiah when the scriptures tell us that the Christ, the Messiah, is going to reign forever? So the scriptures say of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. And actually, this is quite similar to the objection that we began with, isn't it? Surely God's promised one wouldn't die, would he? Seems a bit too weak. You know, what kind of a son of man could you be talking about? Let's keep going. Verse 35. So Jesus said to them, the light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light. So Jesus is saying here that if you can't see the light of the world, when I'm standing here right in front of you, then a time is going to come when you are going to be stuck in your darkness permanently. If you refuse to see the light while you have it, Jesus says there's actually going to be no hope for you. You see, coming to God, being restored to our Creator, is a spiritual thing. It takes humility. And so for the person who stands with their arms folded like a spoiled child and says, unless God reveals himself, you know, fits in with the way I want him to fit in, unless he reveals himself in the way that I want him to, then I'm simply not going to believe. Well, of course, for that person, Jesus says, even the light that they do have will be taken away. The final verse in our section says this, verse 36. When Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. And it's a chilling verse. So this is the end of Jesus' public ministry. And he's illustrating the warning that he's just given, that we need to respond to the light we've been given before it's too late. But, says Jesus, he says, walk while you have the light. Which is an encouragement. If we do respond to the light that we have received, we'll get more. And we'll even be transformed to become sons of light. Verse 36. She says we'll be transformed, changed inwardly, and we'll shine forth Jesus' character in the world. So why does the Creator God reveal himself to human beings through one peasant dying on a wooden cross at one place and one time? Well, quite apart from it being the most awesome display imaginable of God's love and God's justice and God's power and God's wisdom, the cross is also deliberately designed to divide people. So do you see that for proud people who are fixated with power and cleverness and who refuse to admit their need of a saviour, the cross is always going to sound weak. It's always going to sound foolish. But for humble people who know their helplessness before God, who know their need of God's rescue, the cross will always be the most wonderful event imaginable, the event for which they will praise God for endless ages. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain, we're told in Revelation 5. And actually, these verses are a great encouragement for us if we're struggling with doubts and questions and spiritual confusion. Because these verses answer for us, where do we look to see God most clearly? And the answer is, look again at the cross. That is where God's glory, that is where God's light shines the brightest. This was the experience of for a guy called Edward Shillitoe. Shillitoe was in the trenches back in the First World War, 100 years ago this year. And the horror of that experience deeply disturbed him. And actually, for some people here, maybe you've had horrific experiences yourself that have raised all kinds of questions for you. And Shillitoe was confronted with this question: where is God in the midst of all this darkness? And in the midst of his questioning, he found the light that he needed from looking at the cross of Jesus. And he wrote a famous poem about it, and here's a little bit of the poem. The other gods were strong, but thou wast weak. They rode, but thou didst stumble to a throne. But to our wounds, only God's wounds can speak. And not a God has wounds, but thou alone. And actually, this has been the experience of millions. In the midst of all kinds of skepticism and doubts and questions, it's at the cross where we can see the light of God shining most clearly, and where we can at last find the answers we've been searching for. And so, of course, the cross is not just simply where we need to look to see God's glory, but it's the place where we need to be pointing others. Perhaps you've had this experience, as you drop the cross of Jesus into conversation, and maybe some of the Christian Street Conversation guys have had this experience this afternoon, it always sounds weak and pathetic, and you always think, I wish I had something more impressive to talk about. We have that longing, don't we, when we are talking about Jesus and the gospel, that we could point to something a bit more impressive than that. Later in this gospel, one of the disciples asks, Lord, how is it that you'll manifest yourself to us and not to the world? And you can hear something of that disciple's exasperation in his tone. Jesus, why don't you show yourself in a mighty, overwhelming display of power? Then surely everyone would have to believe. But of course, Jesus resolutely sets his face towards the cross, because he knows that that is where God's glory is going to be clearly displayed. And this longing that we have for Jesus to do something impressive is very strong in us. Lots of us here will know about the late John Wimber, who formed the Vineyard Fellowship. He wrote a best-selling book in the 80s called Power Evangelism, and that had a huge impact on the churches that I was connected with when I was growing up. And the argument of the book is that this weak message about the cross is fine, but it's not sufficient in itself. It's not enough to either to convert people or to provide assurance for the believer. Something more is needed, and that something is power. That something is contemporary miracles. And of course, that resonates with us, doesn't it? You know, we love and we long for visible success and confirmation, whether that's miracles and deliverance, or perhaps for some of us here, whether that's numbers on seats, you know, taking someone to a venue that's absolutely packed, or whether that's cultural influence, or whether it's revival, or whatever it is. And of course, these are good things. But we must be careful that we don't despise the way in which the Lord has deliberately chosen to advance his kingdom, which is through a message of weakness and shame. You see, the Lord knows exactly what he's doing, and he's deliberately chosen to reveal himself in this way. So I wonder how you would answer the question, where would you say is the most powerful display of the power of God in the world today? Well, surely it's when the foolish message of the cross is proclaimed and when one sinner turns to God. That is what makes the angels in heaven go wild. Check it out. Look at that. Look at that miracle. And yet it seems so ordinary, doesn't it? I guess just as Jesus' earthly life seems so ordinary to those people around him. But like the cross itself, if we have eyes to see it, that is where true power and glory is to be found. Now, of course, there will be a day when Christ returns in power. There will be a day when he comes in visible glory, when every knee will have to bow to him. But that day is not here yet. And in some days, you and I should be thankful that that day has not yet arrived. On that day when we long for, on that day when no doubts will remain, when there's going to be no more sneering, when everyone in the world will be convinced, on that day, of course, it will be too late for faith, because the day of salvation will have passed forever. Now, when Noah was busy building his apparently pointless boat, I'm waiting for that scene in the blockbuster that's about to come out. He probably longed for some dramatic inbreaking of the power of God, something which would shut up those people who were constantly making fun of him. But when that great inbreaking came, sadly, it was too late for his contemporaries, because God had closed the door of the ark. So, of course, we need to persuade people, don't we, that the flood of God's judgment is coming. But as we do so, let's thank God that the rain, that great inbreaking which is going to finally convince the world, let's thank God that it hasn't begun to fall yet. Just next to that graffiti, which I showed us at the beginning, there was the graffiti about the boy worshipping the God who was dying on a cross. There's another scribbling which was found next to it, which says, in translation, Alexamenos is faithful. And we don't know who wrote it. Perhaps Alexamenos wrote it, or perhaps another believer wrote it. And it's a declaration that true faithfulness involves being unashamed of the God who embraces weakness and shame for us. And it's my prayer that we, as a barge, we would be faithful like Alexamenos was, that we would be unashamed of a weak and suffering God.